Hello and welcome to Reclaiming My Theology, a podcast seeking to take our theology back from ideas and systems that oppress. I'm your host, Brandy Miller, and this is a bonus episode. Today I am joined by the ever-lovely Sarah Bessie to talk about how we can reclaim our lives in theology in the wilderness. We talk about what is lost when we begin to ask questions about our faith and our own lives, what happens when we change our minds, and the hope that exists on the other side of it all. At Reclaiming My Theology, we're also currently in the midst of Lent. Well, it's not just Reclaiming My Theology, it's the church calendar. But it's a space of reflection and an invitation in our space to a more liberated life and life living like Jesus as the liberator. So if you like what you hear on the podcast and want more of that and to support the ongoing work that we're doing, or you just want access to a day-by-day Lenten devotional, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/reclaimingmytheology. We always also desire your questions and stories of how the show has reached you. You can send those to reclaimingmytheology@gmail.com. As always, thanks for all of the ways that y'all show up in sharing, rating, buying merch, sharing kind words, and everything in between. I hope that this episode can be a soft reminder of how we can show up together and pursue healing, wholeness, and new imagination. With that, enjoy this episode with Sarah Bessie. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your time. It's a delight to get to connect, both personally, but also in this context as we one, celebrate the release of your most recent book, but also just as we find ways to connect our communities around the mutual work that we're doing. So thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Brandy. It's so nice to see you.
It's so nice to see you too. Well, Sarah, for folks who don't know you, and I know a lot of folks out there know you from various capacities, but for folks who don't know you or don't know you in this season, I'd love for you to describe for them, what does it mean to be you right now?
Oh man, I love how you frame this question. It's so, I think like a lot of us, maybe a little bit of a complicated answer, right? I think where we've found ourselves at this moment in time. So, I mean, the headline stuff for, yeah, I'm a writer. I live in Canada and a mom of four and have been leading Evolving Faith, which is a community for folks who are in the midst of a bit of a faith shift. For the last 5 or 6 years. But I think that like most of us, that's just the headline stuff, right? There's all the things that kind of go in and go around underneath all of that. We all have a lot of subtext. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the things that maybe most of us are starting to get our heads around anyway.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And I hear even in that description of what it means to be you, the reality that a lot of us are facing, that being us currently can't be fully divorced from the things that are happening in the world around us, where we are inundated with images and experiences of persistent war and violence, political upheaval, and all of those things. And that when someone asks, what does it mean to be you? The individual representation of that is really challenging when we're trying to hold the collective. So I can hear some of the tension dripping in even
right.
The, what does it mean to be right now? It's like, I write and I do things and I lead a community. That's exactly how I totally feel right now.
Like, here's all these things. And also I walk around and light candles and pray and cry and go for walks and fight with God and try to raise my kids. And just all those things are all happening at the same time.
Yes, yes. And that is that's a great way to put it. And I think this will actually be relevant even as we have this conversation about these wilderness spaces that we find ourselves in the ways that we pursue a faith that can hold more of us, is that being realistic about who and where we are becomes a very present and pressing thing to engage with. Because I think a lot of my spirituality taught me that there was this esoteric, really good thing out there, and there was this hellscape here and a hellscape later, so you were just trying to avoid the double hellscapes to get to the esoteric place later. And so everything lived inside of me, like everything, it was like, how do I feel spiritually and not how is my body impacted by seeing images of dying or dead children every day, and how does that move me not toward just prayer but toward something that changes systems and structures or pushes back politically. And all of that feels really hard to hold when the spiritual background I was given said, well, you just pray about it, or like you just trust God, or you just have faith, when for a lot of us we've realized that that has not worked. It's not worked.
And even the emptiness of it, like I came up, my religious tradition or background is more a kind of a branch of neo-charismatic movement. So Pentecostal adjacent, but further down the line, right? And very word of faith, prosperity gospel focus. That was my lane or my background. And so even those dynamics of that prayer is a means of control and controlling outcomes, that extols prosperity, whether that's in health or finances or relationally or whatever else, with your own faith and goodness, like somehow you earned it. Yes. And then, so having to undo all of that, like you were saying, just here's the thing that you were given, a framework you were given for understanding the world. And then you all of a sudden are like, well, if you're a person for longer than a hot second, you realize that that's garbage. Right? That's yes. not actually how things are. And what does it mean to hold and learn lament, but also presence and participation and cooperation? What does it mean to actually engage? Those were questions that I can't say that were a huge part of,
right,
of how that was. And so you're having to relearn that as an adult, sometimes far into your adulthood. In a way that almost feels like relearning the alphabet or relearning how to move through kind of your life on the very basic things.
Yes. Yeah. And it reminds me, and this might feel a little off somewhere else, but I promise it's maybe just how my brain works.
Listen,
but
I'll go anywhere you want to go, think, Brandy. You know that.
I do. It makes me think a little bit about horseshoe theory, which in politics is essentially the idea that like the extremes of both the right and the left kind of horseshoe and meet in similar places. And so you might end up with like particular types of policies or practices or even things like in U.S. politics around Israel and Gaza, like where you're like, how are you all on the same team about this thing? And I think that sometimes when I think about my fundamentalist Christian background and progressive Christianity, the point where the horseshoe kind of connects is that change happens fast and it happens outside of you. Mm-hmm. That it's not about deeper character formation that can hold all of the stuff that you're describing. And so I think I've experienced, and I know a lot of people in this community have experienced, a lot of cognitive dissonance as we seek to be more just or pursue a better world. Because, right, in conservative Christian spaces, it's you want to pursue a better world. In progressive spaces, you want to pursue a more healed and good world. Mm-hmm. On the right, you want to pursue a more healed world. And so the mechanisms might be entirely different. The outcomes might be totally different, but the way that we posture ourselves ends up being the same, which is why I've been fascinated by this idea that you explore so openly about the wilderness, these kind of in-between spaces between us trying to live just and whole and good lives while also rejecting the things that have placed us in harmful environments ourselves or helped or produce context where we perpetuate harm ourselves. And so I would love if you could talk a little bit about this idea of the wilderness. What do you mean when you talk about that? And how did you come to be interested in that idea yourself?
Yeah, the notion of wilderness as a metaphor is certainly not one that's new, right? I mean, it's an old and ancient one. I think the place where I began to really explore it was probably more than 10 or 12 years ago, of just seeing it almost in my mind as here's this liminal space. And so for me, like the notion of the city became almost like this stand-in for certainty and conditional belonging and behaving within this proper, very tiny box lane or whatever else. And I mean, a lot of us have different reasons why maybe we cross that threshold and leave that. And it's complicated, right? It's a complicated thing to even talk about how we enter the wilderness or those liminal spaces in our faith where we're not who we were, and yet we're not yet sure who we're becoming. Mm-hmm. Because some of us land in the wilderness by choice, right? Whether it's because of circumstances. I think one of the shared experiences almost all of us have crossing that threshold into the wilderness is usually something akin to grief. Yes. It can masquerade as anger. It can masquerade as theology questions. It can masquerade as a lot of different things. But underneath it, there's usually a lot of loss and a lot of grief.
Yes.
And yet I say that knowing like the city's kind of built for women like me, right? Like it just is. And so my experience of entering those liminal spaces is very different than someone who never belonged to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so then even those experiences of loss and grief are very different. And so I think that's where even the notion of wilderness emerged for us, even and became kind of part of the fabric of Evolving Faith. Rachel Held Evans and I started Evolving Faith, and the wilderness was this metaphor that both of us really loved. She was super into Planet Earth. series. It was one of her great nerdy loves, her and Dan. And And so like we were always talking about and I think there was this connection as well of just wandering, right? And the notion of you don't have to speed walk your way through this or arrive immediately, or switch one type of certainty for another type of certainty, that this liminal space is actually a really holy invitation from the spirit. It's not a mark of faithlessness. It's not a mark of pride. It's, I think I've heard about 16,000 different ways that people like to talk about deconstruction. Never once have I talked to someone who's been like, you know what, I want to do fornicate, so I'm going to go ahead and question everything I've ever believed. Like, it's, you right. know, those aren't the things. And so people find themselves there for all sorts of reasons. But these liminal spaces, and I think one of the reasons why we like the wilderness metaphor is because there is a sense of danger to it. There's a sense yes. of unchartedness to it, or unchartedness to you, mm-hmm. because that doesn't mean that other people haven't traversed this terrain before, or that there aren't these yes. little kind of like almost like campfires where you find each other and rest for a minute and have mm-hmm. a sense of camaraderie or a realization that like you're not as alone as you thought. Yes. And there's a lot of people who are exploring and who are questioning and who are curious, or even being reintroduced to the wilderness inside themselves, and the wildness that they've always carried. I mean, those are things that are all true, mm-hmm. right? And so, yeah, I think that's maybe where it started. I mean, originally too. So I live in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, and so we spend a lot of time outside. And I think that's maybe part of where the idea for the book came, was like this idea of like field guides, of just things that mm-hmm. you can tuck in your back pocket and carry with you from mm-hmm. someone who's walked the path a little bit and could not only point out like, here's some ditches that I maybe wandered mm-hmm. into, or hey, avoid this trail because it'll add 8 hours to your hike. Yeah. It's also things like, here's something beautiful to keep an eye out for.
Yes.
Here's the yes. reason why it's worth it. Here's what you're going to yes. find on the other side of this. And that's what I envisioned, I yes. think, for it.
And that feels so important, as many of us are. I think what I'm discovering in this season, right? I think there's this massive wave of deconstruction that has now flattened into this dull mm-hmm. hum where a lot of us are asking, does any of this matter? Like, yes. if I strayed so far from the thing that I believed in before, if I don't hold the same ideas or values or practices that I did before, is this even worth pursuing, or what is left to pursue? And so mm-hmm. I love the idea of having space to wander. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's also challenging, because wandering is such a prevalent image in the Hebrew scriptures. Jesus basically spends all of his time walking and wandering around. Like, if you map out Jesus's walkings, like where he goes in the Gospels, particularly in Mark, it is just a doozy, because it's mm-hmm. clearly not the most practical route.
Where's the strategic plan? Where is that?
It's not a multiplicative movement.
See, a vision for multi-site campuses here, Jesus.
Yeah, it's exactly. And so I think what ends up happening, though, is that we have this image of Jesus wandering. We have Israel wandering in the desert. We have all these sorts of things happening. And yet the images that we're given, or the sentiments that we're given about what faithfulness is to stay. Mm-hmm. It is to stay in a singular place. It is to stay in particular people's arms, in their grasp, in their power. And I heard you say, when you made that like passing comment about you've never met a person who starts deconstructing their faith because they want to fornicate. Like, I think that it's the sentiment is silly, but I think it is true, in that most of us encounter, when we start to walk away from those spaces or realize that they have caused us pain or trauma or done so to mm-hmm. our people, that there are all of these bad faith excuses or justifications that people who once held us and institutions that once held us will weaponize and wield against us. And so it feels like when you start a wandering journey, there is this process where faithfulness looks like staying, and therefore unfaithfulness is going. And so anything you do that falls outside of the spaces of non-exploratory, concrete, certain church Christianity ends up feeling in our bodies maybe sinful, problematic, or something, because we conflate the Holy Spirit with indoctrination. Mm-hmm. And I think the wilderness is the place where I've watched a lot of people wrestle with that particular tension. How do I reclaim my body from indoctrinating forces that have tricked me into thinking they're God?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. I think that's one of the things that was really freeing for me in this process, was realizing, I think initially, and maybe because my experience, my very first experience with faith shift happened long before this conversation. and long before like the oversaturation of it, even, you yes. know, where now all of a sudden it's like the word even ceases to have any meaning beyond what the person who's
most certainly
using it means by yes. it, right? And so there was this sense, I think, of that's actually is how it's set up. And that is actually how it's viewed. And I remember when the very first time I started encountering, like, there's a half a dozen people who've written really beautifully and well and done tremendous amount of studies around the spiritual formation of these stages of life, right? From Ricord to James Fowler and Brian McLaren, you know, all sorts of Richard Rohr. There's all kinds of things here. But I remember coming across it in James Fowler's, and he talked about how at that early, there's like six stages of faith he talked about. And at that initial stage that most of our churches are set up to support and foster tends to be very literal. And it tends to be very, if this, then that. If you do this, then this will be what happens. Mm-hmm. And anyone who questions that or says, but what about, or I don't know about that, or this doesn't line up, is automatically seen as like the enemy, because that's how you preserve the center of the thing that you're doing. And the way that that validated even my own experiences in faith communities, hey, no, I'm still me. Do you not all see this? Do you not all see these questions? Do you not have these same wonderings? Are you not bothered by some of these things? Are you not, you can't square some of these circles, right? And I think that that's one of the things even we've talked about, you know, in other ways around, hey, you keep calling this good fruit. And as far as I can tell, it's killing a lot of people. And it's hurting a lot of people. And so this is, can we not talk about the tree that we're all dancing around here? And so I think that that realization of that's not a bug, that is actually the feature of the mm-hmm. system. And that's how yes. the boundaries are created and the fences are created. And so, yeah, there is a sense of wandering, but there's also a feeling of discomfort to that, because
yes.
people are very invested in not understanding that you are actually in the wilderness, or you have entered this stage of spiritual formation. You've entered this stage of change and evolution mm-hmm. and healing, even, I would argue, in a lot of cases, because yes. most of us have a lot of healing to do from how we started off yes. in this story, that it's actually an invitation of the Spirit.
Yes. Yes. And that invitation of the Spirit is so beautiful and so complicated. Because I think that, well, I was talking to a friend recently, and mm-hmm. we were talking about how when we are in faith spaces, we don't actually analyze the animating values of the things that we're asking of people. So when we're asking people to stay in these rigid lines,
yeah.
or when we're asking people to not care about the war, when we're asking people not to care about Black Lives Matter, when we're asking people to not care about the harm that is caused by our theology causes LGBTQ+ people, like, when we ask us, we're not asking the question, what is animating that value? What is animating that request? Mm-hmm. And is the question, like the one that you're just asking, is this harmful to anyone? Or is the question, is this about moral objectivity? And I think that mm-hmm. moral objectivity is a pretty bad God, and mm-hmm. yet it is one that we worship. And so oftentimes, like when I was taught that I shouldn't explore queerness, like my own or even affirmation of anyone else's, a lot of the questions that were being asked were about like, well, what does the Bible say? Or what does God say? Or right. what are the consequences if you decide to live this lifestyle or whatever? That's in quote, heavy quotes. Like,
I just became an embodiment of the cringe face emoji.
Yes. Yes. But right, the question isn't, does being queer cause you or anyone else harm in like a practical sense? It becomes, mm-hmm. is there an esoteric spiritual fear out there of God later that should animate how you operate now? And because we don't ask questions about those animating values, are we talking about harm or hierarchy, or are we talking about moral superiority? Are we talking about these kind of, I don't have any other words other than like my overly private liberal arts education, like an ideological tautology where we say something is true and then we create context to reify the notion that that thing is true. Is that what we're doing? And mm-hmm. I think when we don't ask questions about those animating values, we end up in spaces where we can only see God as a figure to disappoint and the community as a community of people to be abandoned by.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I've been asking a lot of questions, even to the tune of what you're saying, around what are the questions that we can ask and why do we ask them, not just what are the questions or what are the consequences for them. It's asking, when I ask a question about war, is this harmful to anyone, or is this subverting hierarchy in a way that is meaningful? Like, how am I engaging with the necessary unhooking from moral objectivity as the only way that I decide what I do or do not believe, when I have a whole body that's experiencing things that are profoundly, that are profound and capable of giving me information about God, God's self. Mm-hmm. And so I think the wilderness is this interesting space where we can question our animating values in a way that there literally is no space for in the spaces that we come from.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And I think that it does feel like a stripping away, which is maybe why it feels so painful to so many of us in the beginning, because it does feel like not only are you losing old versions of yourself, but you are losing the story you told.
Yes.
About the world and about your place in it and about how you relate to it. Oftentimes you're losing God in the way that you've understood God. Mm-hmm. And so those things come alongside of the very real currency of belonging within spaces like this, which requires a script to be followed. Mm-hmm. And when you step out of line, the repercussions are swift because that's how it's set up. Right. Yeah. And so it's not surprising that that's so many people's experience. And that's why I wonder. I don't know. I don't know if there's a way to have that without that sort of loss, because you almost have to lose and unlearn before you can have the space to relearn or reimagine or enter into whatever's new. It's almost like you have to leave the one room you're in order to enter the next one. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. And that I see a lot of, as I hear a lot of the discourse about people who are asking questions about their faith, I think what ends up happening is, because I do think that there is a way that our ethics and our values and some foundational things can be good fences as we explore or as we discover.
For sure.
I think that's great. I think it's necessary to have those ethical boundaries. But I think what ends up happening is we give theological boundaries or theological consequences as those fences. And I do not think those are good fences, because they reflect some kind of sentiment that God is more concerned with our compliance than our whole personhood. And that the love of God is not high enough, wide enough, deep enough, good enough to hold us in our exploration. And so I think that when ethics are not our center point and theological compliance is, we will only get so far. And when we only get space to go so far, we will never find ourselves and God in and of ourselves. And so I think I've had a hard time with even what you're describing around when we move even to the doorway of the room, we're told, like, don't stray too far. Like, it was just so ironic, right?
I know.
When I think about some of the most profound animating stories in the Gospels are a son who goes away for a long time and does whatever he wants and comes back on his own terms, even if those terms are bad.
Yeah.
And that God is delighted to invite that person back into sonship. And so I think that there is a challenge for me when people say you can only deconstruct or you can only wander or you can only explore in these ways, because it assumes this character of God that isn't big enough or loving enough or spacious enough to hold all of those things, and replaces it with a God who is more interested in offering repercussions, like you're saying, for the wandering, when I've actually never seen that to be the case. Have I seen anything that I think is God's judgment of people for their exploration? I've never seen it. And maybe you would say, or not you, but the esoteric out there far away, you would say, well, it's because you're, I don't know, desensitized to sin or something. But I've just never seen it. Like, I've just never seen it. What I have seen over and over again is that when people desire to have a connection to the divine and to the community, that there is faithfulness along the way to meet those folks where they are, even after long times of wandering and doing things that maybe they're not even proud of. So I feel like I'm just stuck in that a little bit these days.
You were just about to find out how charismatic I still am, because I went and found a hanky and started waving it in your face on this call. Preach! Preach it! That's the whole word. I think that's one of the things that is so deeply connected to the larger thing that you're saying around this moment in time, the even what I would term like apocalypse. I mean, granted, mm-hmm. word of faith kid and charismatic, of course, I love big King James language, like yeah, apocalypse.
Gestures broadly at self.
Yeah, and, you know, I'll whip out powers and principalities on you here in a minute when I'm talking about all these
things. I speak the language fluently. I can do that.
Right? Okay, good. But there's this thing of around that apocalypse where it does feel like an unveiling, right? That real original truest meaning of the word, that it's a revelation, like that the lights are getting thrown on and all the things that we have politely or deliberately or weren't aware were being swept away are all there, right, for us to see, and there's no hiding any longer. And so that's where that understanding of God, that shift around the welcome and inclusion and goodness and generosity and wideness in God's mercy, that's great for you. And that's a deeply healing work that I would never in a million years want to denigrate or belittle, because that's often the doorway. But then you all of a sudden realize that when that is true, that includes other people too. And that includes other mm-hmm. people's stories. And that includes experiences that are different than yours. And that includes geopolitical areas that are different than where you've understood and you know, being taught to understand. And even the ways that those things are like deeply enmeshed with like nationalism and our place in our nations and how we show up in the world and then how we even show up and understand our identity, right? Which is why I think maybe it's sometimes such a painful thing for people, is because you don't just feel like you're... One of my biggest pet peeves, Brandy. First, gonna get into it. One of my biggest pet peeves is when people act like this experience in the wilderness is about trading one set of theological beliefs for another set.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If I can just yes. change my opinions or change my my theology on whatever. And it's not to say theology is not important, because it is. It's deeply, deeply important. It shows up in every aspect of our lives. It shows up in how we show up with each other, how we show up in the world, how we show up for the questions and moments of our time. Super important.
Sure.
But that's not the totality of this. Like, the totality of this is actually, well, going back to old language again, being born again almost. Right? Like of seeing everything differently, of seeing the welcome and the goodness and the love of God, of seeing the sacramental nature of being alive, of seeing the ways that we are interconnected with one another, of seeing the ways that all of this is tied up together. And once you relearn that, that's not about here's six new answers to an apologetics thing I memorized. This is how you move through your life.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And I think that's where some of the grief and the pain maybe feels most sharp for some of us. Because a lot of mm-hmm. the faith experiences that I was given and that many were given relied on toxic positivity to keep you from the kind of unveilings.
God Almighty.
To say that the earth is bad, the world is bad because of original sin. Like I was just in a Christian college and a kid asked me a question about original sin. And I was like, I asked him straight up, I straight up said, does this question help you get toward answers that actually impact your life or other people? Because he was asking about, I was doing a talk on violence and he was asking essentially, what are the origins of violence or where does violence come from? Does it come from, are we just like it inherently like violent or is it something that we do? And I was like, how does that question help you become less violent and follow the way of Jesus that pulls us into nonviolence? And he was just kind of like, mm-hmm. oh, I guess it doesn't. And so then I was like, okay, well, then why mm-hmm. is that question so important to you? And I've been thinking about it because it feels a little bit like that question is important because it gives a reason for why things are bad instead of just being able to say things mm-hmm. suck and we have to deal with that. And we have to engage with the fact that life is pain and struggle and that God can be good in the midst of life being pain and struggle. But I could just see the wheels in his head turning that were like, wait a second, mm-hmm. like maybe there's just not a reason for why things are like this that gets me outside of myself, but rather invites me into myself. And so I think that unveiling that you're talking about can be so brutal because not only is our faith sort of falling apart straight up, but we are being confronted with a world that is somehow much worse than Christians said it was, but mm-hmm. in ways that you can feel and touch and taste and encounter alongside other people. It's not bad because of original sin. It's bad because of sexism and homophobia and white supremacy and political warfare.
The aforementioned powers and principalities of our age. Here we are.
And so I think it's hard when we're trying to deconstruct, to know more, to gain something, to not just swap for theological principles. But what we end up doing is giving away all of the things that have held us for a long time, that have mm-hmm. been safe in a particular ideological and internal way, and then replace them with a shit ton of grief about the world.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I remember when I was young, you weren't even allowed to say you were sick in some of the faith spaces that I came up in. You weren't sick. You were coming down with a healing. How's that? Which is just, again, it just the way. And so, again, there's all of us have different types of things that we're undoing. And all of us come from different kind of ways of being. Folks I talk to who come from more a different type of background often have to grapple with and heal their view of God, because they've been told, like, God is the one who does this. God's the origin point of mm-hmm. sin and evil. God will use these terrible things in your life to punish you, and you deserve it because you're a worm and a spider held over the fires of hell. Thanks, Jonathan Edwards, slave owner and theologian. And so you have all of these different functions that are happening. But for someone like me, in the background I came up in, which was the toxic positivity thing, you do end up like, well, God's always good. God wants goodness for me. God is faithful. God is love. This beautiful view of God, very high view of God. So you're the problem. If things aren't going well, so you're the problem. So if you're sick, it's your lack of faith. If someone's broke, it's because they are, it's not because of systemic poverty. It's not because of all these other factors that are on the go. It's because of their faith or whatever else. Right. And so even that kind of like particularity of shame, is a heck of a thing to start to undo. And so, I mean, for sure, what boots you over the threshold might be your need to rethink prosperity or how you read scripture or atonement theories or whatever. Like, sure, whatever, right? Whatever turns the key in the lock, knock yourself out. But at the end of the day, what you're really actually experiencing is that you're going to have to learn how to be a person. Yes. You're going to have to learn how to be a person in this world. You're going to have to stop pathologizing humanity. You're going to stop having to act like you've got a fast pass or an app hack to get out of the experience of being a person. Because this is what it is.
Yes. And I think that is true. That is so true. And I'm hearing, even in the ways that you're describing some of the theology that has held some of that, this high view of God means a low view of self. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, if we're going to horseshoe theory this, what ends up happening, I think, is that we start to deconstruct, and then we have a low view of God and a high view of self, and we still live in hierarchy. Yes. And I think someone might be triggered to be like, oh, are you saying you're as good as God? Like, that's not even a question I ask. It doesn't matter. Does this question actually help us get anywhere? But I think I just wonder, like, why is it that in a lot of deconstruction spaces, it's low view of God, high view of self. In a lot of conservative spaces, it's high view of God, low view of self. And I'm like, we can have a high view of God and a high view of self, and let those high views of the goodness of God and the goodness of humanity shape us into a more just society. But that feels so hard to do when a lot of the Christianity that we've been given has to exist in binaries. There has to be an either or. There has to be a He is greater than me, who is in the world, like more of him, less of me. And instead of saying, oh, I think John was probably really secure in his relationship to God, I don't think he's saying, like, I'm the worst person in the whole world. I think he's naming his role in a big mm-hmm. story where he's not the center. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean a low view of self. It means a high view of God and a high view of the story that allows him to take a high view of self mm-hmm. and others alongside him. And so I think that kind of that those parallels feel really challenging. And I think that many of us, and this is fair, do not know how to pursue both a high view of God and a high view of humanity when those things have been put at odds.
Well, because you're basically having to relearn your entire view of how we're moving through the world, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that's maybe part of the process, right? I think most of us go through, I think especially in the early days of when you very first kind of flailingly find yourself catapulted into this thing that is no longer like a park, but a thing that could swallow you whole. We can overcorrect, maybe, if that makes sense, because we are needing that healing. And I think that that's even part of the process, is yes, that burn it down stage, that steering into some things in order to steer back or to find kind of that path that has been so elusive to us. And so I don't know that anyone gets to skip that part, the messy part, mm-hmm, the flailing part, the I didn't get things right and I have some regrets part. Just as zealous as we can be in fundamentalism or purity culture or certainty, we can be that zealous and unflinching and unforgiving on the other side. But that's where I think that joy of high view of God, high view of people, high view of ourselves calls us deeper, calls us further in, calls us to that kind of embodiment, that kind of, so what are you going to do differently? So how is this going to actually matter in your life? Like that question you were asking the student, right? Like, how is this actually going to help you follow Jesus better? Are you looking for a get out of jail free card? Are you looking for a reason that you can, or an excuse? Or are you missing the most obvious invitation that is here now? And so, yeah, I think that's maybe some of the hard part, is I think maybe we were taught or told that we get to skip that part, that we just get to jump right to arrival, and we don't understand that so much of what we learn is in that mess, and even the people around us and alongside of us during that, right?
Yes. And I think it goes back to some of the stuff we were saying earlier about faithfulness, but even the notion that faithfulness in the way that you're describing right now is compliance, is what a lot of us are taught.
It's, right.
Well, really, the big word is obedience. It's submission. It's submission to God and God's will. It's not my will, but yours be done. It's making ourselves Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's making us Jesus in those spaces. And I think I wonder, for many of us who are trying to figure out, what is faithfulness right now? Because mm-hmm. If faithfulness has always been obedience and compliance in a particular way, what does it mean to be faithful in a season where we don't really feel like we know God or ourselves, or maybe the world that we live in, or if we do know the world we live in and how much of a train wreck it is, how to be in it faithfully? Like, what do you mm-hmm. think about faithfulness in this season as you consider the wilderness as a space?
I love this way of approaching it. Like, what is faithfulness, I think, in this moment? And I think it's one of those things that I grapple with a lot, personally. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason why is because one of the areas that I had to personally deconstruct was this evangelical hero complex. The idea of it's up to you to save the world. And it's up to you to save everything. And you have got to sacrifice everything on the altar of almighty ministry or like whatever else. And I watched as people were just chewed up and spat out in yes. service to the churn of this thing, and just, mm-hmm. you know, destroyed mentally, physically, emotionally, relationally, spiritually, because they were trying to be faithful. And yet, so I deconstruct all of that. I get very, very comfortable with a smaller life and a more steady mm-hmm. life and a very engaged life in my actual mm-hmm. place. I stop yes. separating the work of my life into two piles that are somehow in my head working against each other. Here's the things I do that are sacred, and here's the things I do that are mm-hmm. secular, and here's the things I'm doing for Jesus, and here's the things I'm actually just doing laundry or bringing food to my neighbor or whatever, right? And so healing that divide, I think, actually has given me the path of what faithfulness is, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Like, instead of looking at it as what is the big, sexy, sacrificial thing that is going to make the missions newsletter. Or what, in all the places and moments of your life, what does it mean to be faithful? What does it mean to embody the things that you actually hope for about the world? What is the thing that you are going to dare to let yourself have some hope for? And so one of the ways that I have found, or a path of faithfulness that I've found in this, and it's, I envy the people who land in these things and they're able to be like, here's six steps and I guarantee it'll work all the time, because that's just not the world that we live in. But one of the things that has been helpful for me, I will offer this, has been that notion of naming what I am for instead of just what I am against. Mm-hmm. And that has been a path of faithfulness for me in this moment in time, for instance.
It's good.
Especially when I think a lot of us are overwhelmed or having to rethink ways that we've been taught to view the world, ways we've been taught to view our place in the world or our community's place in the world or whatever else, or we're relearning things that we maybe never knew and we should have known or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's important to name what you're against, and that matters. It's deeply important to be able to do that. But not stopping there and being curious about what is it I'm actually for, and then how can I live into that in the dailiness of my life, not as this big sacrificial, submissive obedience kind of narrative, but in the how I'm actually showing up in my life. If this is a thing I'm hoping for, if this is a thing I want to be for, then how am I going to actually, what am I going to do different? Or how am I going to show up in that? And so that little shift in perspective of not just against, but also having room for and moving towards what I want to be for, gives me a path to contribute or build or be part, to participate, but also not to center myself either, right? But to see myself as part of what is moving in that direction. And what I genuinely believe is the movement of the Spirit. And what I genuinely believe is an invitation there to cooperate with and co-create with and even collaborate with one another on that path of, this is a thing that we believe about God. This is, if I think that God is generous and loving and inclusive and welcoming, that's going to change how I show up in my life, right?
Yes.
Or it should.
Yes. Yes. And that will change how I approach what I am against.
Right.
Like, I think that a lot of the work I've done of being against systems of oppression and violence and whatever is learning how to live a smaller and more sacred life alongside people that change me such that I would know how to do the work.
Exactly.
Because I did a lot of screaming into the void. In the early aughts.
It was a time. It was a time and a place.
I screamed into that void. And you know what I did?
And if screaming into the void
made myself feel
worked, we could have done it.
Yep. It made me feel good about myself. It made other people feel bad about themselves, which also made me feel good about myself. But didn't actually help me to be more grounded in the things that I said I was about. And so even as we've been in this journey with the community around purity culture, I think that conversation on what am I for versus what am I against is a really profound and interesting one. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to make you talk a bunch about purity culture or something, but I do recognize that we've been taught like, don't have sex, don't lose your virginity, don't whatever. But instead of saying, I'd actually like to have a really good and fulfilling sex life, I would like to have consent, responsibility, and respect that makes it so that I am against sexual violence, but in a way that's practical and not just ideological.
Yes.
And so I think a lot of what the church has done in being just against things, particularly in this purity culture movement, is that it has created no context to actually live a safe and good and just and responsible and consensual world. Even if some people would say that that's what they want, the culture itself doesn't allow for that. And so I think saying in this season what we are for, like, we're not just like against the abstract concept of virginity, but we're for knowing your own body and knowing the stories that dictate what your romantic and sexual sensibilities are. Like, that's a really different question. And so I know that plays out differently in race and patriarchy and all of those sorts of things, but I do think that naming of what we're for allows us to operate more ethically and I think in a more faithful way in the things that we are against, because we actually know we have a taste of the world that we're aiming for rather than just an abstracted fear about what the world shouldn't be.
Right. Exactly. And then even to your point, like about the horseshoe, you end up back in the exact same thing again. right? Mm-hmm. And so that sort of pathway it's a more difficult one, because to your point, like it's fun, or not fun, but there's a sense of I don't know. This is what I meant about how I'm not really great at thinking on my feet, but there's more this sense to me within it of don't settle for just the scream into the void, mm-hmm. right? Because then you can look around you and you can say, you know, what does it mean in my actual community? What does it mean within my province or state? What does it mean in the larger world? But also, what does it mean with the person who's sitting right beside me? Mm-hmm. And what is this thing that we're trying to build and be, and how we actually want to move through the world? And I don't know that we get to cultivate that kind of hopefulness by accident. Like, it feels like it has to be very purposeful, because everything yes. around us is saying something different, or has created a framework that almost has to be untangled in order to have that level of even hopefulness and possibility. I feel like, too, there's even an invitation to imagination there mm-hmm. that maybe we've forgotten, yeah. which to me, a lack of imagination often feels and sounds a lot like despair. Right? This is the way it's always been. This is the way it will always be. I can't find a way clear. I can't, whatever else. I couldn't even imagine, for instance, sexual ethic that didn't revolve around purity culture and virginity or whatever else, right? And so almost feels like snatching back something from those jaws of despair when you dare to imagine and you dare to like even have some room or some hopefulness for the almost the baptism of your imagination to become yes. that more sacramental yes. place of, no, my actual lived body, this actual experience in this body, in this place, yes. with these people, at this moment in time, what is that going to look like for me? And what is a little bit of hope I could wrestle out from that and maybe lean into or chase for a little yes. while?
Yes. Sorry, excuse me. Yeah, and in that making room for imagination, we make room for nuance, mm-hmm. for nuance in ourselves and for nuance in the world and for nuance that honestly the scriptures weren't really trying to do, like that people aren't really trying to do. And to say that I can hold two ideas at the same time and not be like, oh my God, I'm serving two masters now, that I can hold that something like in this conversation on purity culture, that something is not a structure of relationship that I would use for my own life, but that might be meaningful and good and sacred for another person. And that I can hold that my imagination can have enough room that can exist and I can exist. And that I can mm-hmm. hold those without judgment or the need to control. And that I can imagine a world where people can be fully themselves within their values, and that's none of my business. And so mm-hmm. I think that when we get to have imagination, we also get to say, some stuff is not my business, because I can imagine a world yeah. where there can be a coexistence of multiple things at the same time. There can be a both and that actually feels a lot like Jesus, to hold complicated in-between spaces with differing people and allow there to be space for all of them to show up in a particular way. And so I think that that's really, really meaningful. And I guess I wonder then, as we close, what is a piece of advice that you would give to someone who is trying to practice imagination and practicing a new world as they wander and as they hold the grief of the world that we talked about at the beginning that is ever present and all around them? Yeah, how would you walk someone into imagination in a world of grief and in this space of wilderness?
So for me, one of the pathways that, or practices maybe is a better way to put it, has been letting myself love the world again. And not like in a general sense, right? The way that we were maybe be like, well, first of all, we were taught not to love the world, right? To despise the world, to hate the world, to blah, 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 right? It's whole other conversation. So there's that you have to undo. But then even there's this idea of like, in general, you just love the world, you know? Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think this was really early days of the pandemic for me, where I almost had this sense of, what does it mean to love the world in particular, as opposed to in generalized terms, yes. Or big, wide, overwhelming terms even. I think maybe because my life got so small, in those first years of this. And there was this invitation of, all right, what does it mean to love the world in particular? What does it mean to open up room for love to grab hold in a very particular sense, as opposed to a very general sense? I remember hearing this one interview on CBC with this wonderful Indigenous poet named Billy Ray DeBelcourt. And he had this line in his poem where he said, to love someone is to consent to being devastated by them. And I think there's almost this sense of consent to loving in particularity, like what he illuminated there, of being able to say, it might break my heart to love this. It might break my heart to love this person. It might break my heart to love this particular movement or cause or this thing that I'm putting my energy and my time into. It is going to break my heart, and I'm going to consent right at the get-go to that likelihood, because that's the price of loving is grief, and it always comes and collects. But that particularity is what led me to things like the actual kids in my home and what they need and needed, and we have some higher needs in our home. What does it mean to love this in particular and take joy in this? What does it mean then to love things in particular? Well, it looks like minus 40 at the food bank asking car after car what kind of protein they want this week. Right? And this kind of level of particularity and learning to love and in particular helped rebaptize my imagination for the larger invitations of love and faithfulness that are around us, because it stopped being abstract and it stopped being an enemy, or it stopped being a danger zone or a ditch, and it became a practice in your actual real walking around embodied life right now, as opposed to for someday for the really holy people, right? Or the ways that we've even separated out who gets to be the people who are doing this work and the rest of us are just pew fodder or, you know, part of the machine or whatever else, right? It's no, there's an invitation here for us. And I think that that's been one that I have found to be a good practice to love something in particular, to help learn to love the world again. It's almost like it created an on-ramp, if that makes sense.
That's so good. And I think that's true of, I don't know if a lot of us would name it in that exact way, but I think an invitation to, or a sudden love for the particular, is a lot of what has led many of us on these journeys that we're on. And so I appreciate the specific invitation to, one, choose into things that many of us have already felt, but to do that as a life practice, as a guiding value, as an approach to life that is full of meaning and goodness outside of just needing to say, again, what we're against or sitting in fear of consequence all the time, because I just think that the love of God is bigger than that. And and that is such a wonderful invitation. So I hold that invitation dearly myself, and hold that for our community here too. It's such a big deal. It's so good. Well, for folks who want to hear more about this journey and some of your points, like, one, I love hearing the candor with which you bring your story, and the irreverency with which you can understand your own experiences and can look back and be like, wow, I was really doing a white lady in Canada thing, and
sure was.
here's what I learned. Where can people find your work? Where can people engage with more of the stuff that you're doing out here?
Oh, thank you. So I guess just my website, sarahbessie.com, and you'll find links for this book, all the other ones, as well as to Evolving Faith, socials, all that kind of fun stuff. But yeah, that's probably a good entry point, I guess, if people are at all curious.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's such a joy to get to talk to you and to get to work through some of these in-between sort of conversations, where we're not just talking about the justice issue or the theological issue, but the how we are in those spaces and how we are people who can maintain our full humanity in the midst of them. And so I so appreciate being companions on the journey to do that together.
I'm so grateful for you, Brandy. I'm so glad that our paths have crossed, and also that you are now stuck with me. So
there you go.